Well, good morning, everyone. It's really beautiful out there. It's a blue sky. How wonderful. We named this Sesshin, Mountains and Waters Sesshin, after one of Dogen Zenji's most beloved writings, the Mountains and Waters Sutra. Usually, sutras are, the word sutra or sutta is used to refer to the very earliest Buddhist texts that were first written down several hundred years after the Buddha died and are said to be the closest to the Buddhist teaching. So it's rather unusual to have something written in the 13th century be called a sutra, and that's the only, Dogen was very prolific, and this is the only thing that he wrote that he called a sutra. Why do you suppose? Well, remember what I read last night? He said, mountains and waters right now are the actualization of the ancient Buddha way. Mountains and waters right now are the actualization of the ancient Buddha way. Each abiding in its phenomenal expression realizes completeness. Because mountains and waters have been active since before the empty eon, which is an unimaginably long time ago, they are alive at this moment. Because we have been the self. And here he means the boundless self, not our small, everyday self. Because we have been the self since before form arose, they are, mountains and waters, are emancipation, realization. That might sound a little abstract. But he's saying that mountains and waters are none other than the Dharma, you know, the teachings of the Buddha, actualized right now. And believe it or not, so are we. That's also, I think Dogen had a very feeling about rivers, and he really felt that they were his teachers. So I think that's why he called it the Mountains and Waters Sutra. Dogen, as I said, lived in the 13th century, and as a young man, he's only about 23, he made a perilous sea journey with his teacher from Japan to China, where he found a teacher who taught him this particular style of practice that we do, Soto Zen or Zaodong in China. And when he returned, Rinzai Zen was already established in Kyoto, where he had lived, and actually there was an even prior form of Buddhism that was really dominant, militantly dominant in Kyoto. So he founded his first monastery in the mountains just outside Kyoto, and then even further away, deep in the mountains of northwestern Japan. It's very beautiful there. Some of us have been on our Sangha trips to Japan, to Eiheiji, which is still 600 years later an active monastery. So, I think Dogen, in his writings and his poetry, really expresses the teachings of the mountains and waters, what they meant to him. We were just in Japan in May. Michael and I had 18 pilgrims. And over we saw the kind of precipitous way that the rivers and streams flow in Japan. Japan's a very mountainous country, and so the rivers are short and steep, and thus prone to flooding, flash flooding. Just like the rivers we crossed on the Sea to Sky Highway on our way here. I don't know if you noticed, some of them said debris torrents, it's called. Not it's like a flash flood, but the water picks up debris as it comes down and becomes even stronger the more debris it carries. And so that's a phenomenon that people in Japan have known well over the centuries, the power of water, of moving water. So Dogen said, mountains have been the abode of great sages from the limitless past to the limitless present. Wise people and sages all have mountains as their inner chamber, as their body and mind. Because of wise people and sages, mountains appear. So, as wise people and sages for these few days, let's take this mountain as our inner chamber, as our body and mind. We are actually at the foot of a great volcanic mountain or chain of mountains formed by the fire at the core of this earth pushing molten rock up and out. Just above us, not far really, if we were crows, we could fly right up there to Black Tusk, which some of you may have climbed or seen pictures of. It's a very dramatic core of a volcano. It looks like a black tusk, where the surrounding rock has eroded away, leaving this core. And my geology is not going to say what it's made of, because I might be wrong. But I bet someone here might know. Any good guesses? Oh, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. It's pretty dramatic. And here we are, and you see the tumbled boulders. Cracked and broken off this mountain. Tumbled down to the base. And we see all the life living on those boulders. Then below us is a lake formed by the waters that flow from the snows and glaciers that accumulate on the mountains around us. Now you may have noted that Dogen describes a reciprocal relationship between the wise people and sages and the mountains. Because of us, mountains appear. How could that be? A little later he says, although mountains belong to the nation, mountains belong to people who love them. When mountains love their master, such a virtuous sage or wise person enters the mountains. Since mountains belong to the sages and wise people living there, trees and rocks become abundant and birds and animals are inspired. This is so because the sages and wise people extend their virtue. You should know as a fact that mountains are fond of wise people and sages. Now, by the rational materialist standards of our day, our present time, it may seem that Dogen is indulging in shameless anthropomorphism. You know, we think it's bad enough to ascribe human feelings to animals, let alone mountains. And yet, maybe he is describing a kind of reciprocality that we have grown so apart from, so deaf and blind to, that it sounds like to us. And I think those of us who have spent time in the mountains and wild places felt a sense of meeting and being met. It says, when you see mountains from the ordinary world, and when you meet mountains while in mountains, the mountain's head and eye are viewed quite differently. So for these few days, we won't have one talk, but we'll, you know, hear the things. Let's meet mountains from within mountains, close up and intimate. Maybe we will find that they are not within ourselves. Those of you who were here last week may remember Dogen's words about mountains and walking. He talks about mountains and walking in this sutra. How mountains walking is like and unlike our own walking. And we also looked at water, and how the form it takes and the way it appears depends on conditions and what kind of creature is viewing or inhabiting it. Living within the mountains, we are close to the elements. Last year, just the week before we came, there had been a big wildfire outside the Seascheldt. You may remember the dense smoke that spread throughout Vancouver one day and then down the Fraser Valley the next. By the time we got here, the smoke had cleared, but it was really hot and dry. A year ago. Still, we were only at the beginning of a drought that extended for weeks later. Weeks beyond into August, and taught us here on the Rain Coast a little bit about what it's like not to have enough water, especially those of us like Michael and I, who have a well out in the countryside. We had to haul water to keep our garden alive. This year we've had lots of rain, and in our human fickleness, we wish for the warmth of the sun to return. Oh, look! But let's go beyond our usual preferences and complaints for a while this weekend and look more deeply into earth, water, fire, and air, the elements within us and all around us. Let's see how Dogen deconstructs our view of water. He says, some beings see water as wondrous blossoms, but they do not use blossoms as water the way we do. He says, hungry ghosts see water as raging fire or pus or blood. So if you don't know what hungry ghosts are, in Buddhist cosmology, there are six realms. There's a hell realm, and right beside the hell realm, these are often, you see it in Tibetan tankas, mandalas with the six sections, and there's the hell realm, and right beside it is the hungry ghost realm. Hungry ghosts are beings with long, skinny necks and great big bellies, and they're never, ever satisfied. And even when they try to drink, their throat will burn. So that realm kind of expresses our perpetual dissatisfaction, right? You know, that realm in us of addiction, of never having enough. So, of course, the hungry ghosts, even if they're surrounded by water, can't see it as refreshing, can't receive it and accept it as refreshment. It burns. We're like that sometimes, aren't we? You know, can't accept the nourishment that's right before our eyes. Dogen says dragons see water as a palace or a pavilion. Some beings see water as a forest or a wall. Some see it as the Dharma nature of pure liberation, the true human body, or as the form of body and essence of mind. Human beings see water as water. Always the pragmatists, right? We think how water can serve our needs. That's kind of the human realm. Water is seen as dead or alive, depending on causes and conditions. So you see what he's doing here is he's just is looking at how water or fire or the mountain is different depending on what kind of relationship, what kind of other being is inhabiting or viewing it. So he says, thus the views of all beings are not the same. You should question this matter now. Are there many ways of seeing one thing? Or is it a mistake to see many forms as one thing? You should pursue this beyond the limit of pursuit. This is how Dogen talks when he's kind of presenting us with a koan, you know. One of those kind of paradoxical truths about reality. So he says, accordingly, endeavors in practice realization of the way are not limited to one or two kinds. The ultimate realm has 1,000 kinds and then 10,000 ways. Dogen often hyphenates practice realization, and it would be two pairs of Chinese characters. And so in English we say practice realization, and the reason he does that is he doesn't see practice being something we slog away at for countless lifetimes and for some kind of eventual realization in the far distant future. He sees practice and realization as being simultaneous, interpenetrating in any moment. In any moment of full presence, we've awakened. Realization is right there. And so it's very important, again, that we don't have a kind of dramatic awakening experience and say, there, I've done it. Then everything's going to be easy from then on. Maintaining our practice, continually maintaining our practice, awakening again and again and again is really important in this way of practicing. So in these passages I just read, Dogen's going beyond water as a substance. And he's using its insubstantiality, its mutability, its changeability to open up our view of everything in the phenomenal world, because everything is like that. To show us that no phenomena have fixed existence, and that phenomena only manifest within a matrix of dynamic relationships. Excuse me. Even our efforts to practice the Dharma are not limited. There are 10,000 ways to practice and realize, he just says. Dharma, in our Bodhisattva vows, we chant, at the end of this talk, we'll chant, Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Dogen goes on, when we think about the meaning of this, it seems that there is water for various beings, but there is no original water. There is no water common to all types of beings. But water for these various kinds of beings does not depend on mind or body, does not arise from actions, does not depend on self or other. Water's freedom depends only on water. That might sound a little bit baffling. Didn't we just say that everything exists in interdependence? So what can he mean when he says water's freedom depends only on water? Because, of course, he's not just talking about water, he's talking about us. Dogen loves to turn and turn us around. Just when he opens us up to the truth, absolute oneness, interconnectedness, he'll turn it again to the simultaneous truth of the particular. Water, fire is fire. Earth is earth, air is air, you are me, I am. You are you, I am me. Your freedom depends on you, and my freedom depends on me. But of course, he doesn't leave it there. Then he turns it again and he says, therefore, water is not just earth, water, fire, wind, space, or consciousness. Water is not blue, yellow, red, white, or black. Water is not forms, sounds, smells, tastes, objects of touch, or mind objects. But water as earth, water, fire, wind, and space realizes itself. Okay, we'll go back over this. So in Buddhist thought, there are usually more than four elements. Besides earth, water, fire, and air, there are also space and sometimes consciousness included as elements. So that's why the list was a little longer than what we're used to. Earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. So he says, water cannot be identified as any of those elements. Water is not just earth, water, fire, space, or consciousness. Nor can its color be fixed. We know that, right? You can look at water and you can see so many different colors because of water's reflected quality. Just look, keep checking the lens and you'll see the water color changing. Nor can water be identified with any of the objects of the senses. Sounds, smells, tastes. Water makes sounds, right? But that's not water. It's the interaction of the water and wind. Or smells. Water can smell different ways, right? Depending on what earth elements are added to it. Or tastes. You can't identify water by taste. It varies depending what's in it. Or sight. So you can't identify water with any of the objects of the senses. When we chanted the Heart Sutra this morning, you may remember, we chanted no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object. Saying that none of the senses or the objects of sense perception exists in any discrete, separate way, right? Only in interaction. They only arise in dynamic interaction. And this is the meaning of what's often called emptiness in Buddhist language, in the Heart Sutra. So maybe the word boundlessness is helpful. So all phenomena are empty, all phenomena are boundless, and exist only in dynamic interaction. That's what Dogen is referring to. Then he goes on to say, but water as earth, water, fire, wind, and space realizes itself. So what he's saying is, no one can live your life for you. Right? No one can do your practice for you. No one can die your death for you. And, not but and, you can only live your life, you can only do your practice, you can only die your death, you can only realize yourself as earth, water, fire, air, and all beings. You can only realize yourself as in connection. Phenomena are brought into being by and with each other. Mountains and sages, you and me, the eagle and the salmon and the forest. Earth, water, fire, and air, met together in a garden fair, put in a basket bound with skin. If you answer this riddle, you'll never begin. that was a song. And if you know it, that dates you. The Incredible String Band, a British folk back in the 70s, sang that. So the more we observe the elements within and around us, the more we see that our lives depend on a delicate balance of those elements. Too little of any of them, and we can't survive, right? Too little sustenance from the earth, we starve. Too little moisture, we die of thirst. Too little heat, we freeze. Too little air, we suffocate. And too much of any of them, and we are in trouble. Or at least very uncomfortable. Too much earth, we're crushed. Too much water, we drown. Too much fire, we burn. Too much air, we are carried off to Oz, like Dorothy in the tornado. Right? The more we observe the elements, the more we see that the relationships between them are in continuous flux. To contemplate the elements is to contemplate impermanence. And to contemplate impermanence is usually to contemplate our preferences, our desires for what we want and our aversion to what we don't want. So we can observe this in the most mundane way by noting our reactions to the weather, right? Or changes in temperature. Oh, it's too hot in here. Or, oh, it's too cold in here. Notice how we talk about the weather, the most conventional topic of human conversation, right? It's all about our preferences. So while we're here this weekend, we have this wonderful opportunity to just notice our reactions to change in wet, dry, hot, cold. Yeah. Just notice and really be present. Just present with each change as it is. You know, we really like to quick intervene, or we're worried about other people being comfortable. But let's practice to some extent. Of course, we want people to be reasonably comfortable, but let's just notice. And be present with our body-mind in our environment. And if we want to go even deeper into our contemplation of the elements and impermanence, we can observe the elemental qualities of our mental-emotional states, right? There's the fiery energy of anger in our body. You know how that feels? You actually feel hot. Or the chill of terror, or anxiety, or the flood of grief, or the tornado of obsessive thoughts and worries, or the smoldering of resentment. We even use words, you know, all the words that we use for these are weather words, right? Or the murk of swampy depression. We can practice simply observing our inner weather and our reactions to it, just like we do the outer weather. And we can ride it out, knowing it will change, right? Even the most aversive states, we can trust that it will change. And sitting on a cushion where we can't run away, we have that option of just staying present and noticing, taking that backward step, shining the light of awareness on body and mind, and not identifying with it quite so much. Yeah. We can learn to allow a state of anger or fear to arise and subside, knowing that these states are temporary, and knowing that these states are subject to causes and conditions, vast causes and conditions, beyond that we can even identify completely or understand completely, just like the weather is. So being aware of our inner states with more and more subtlety, we can call upon the steadiness of the earth element, or the fluidity of the water element, or the energy of the fire element, or the movement of the air element, to balance ourselves, to regulate ourselves when we become imbalanced. And that imbalance threatens to harm ourselves or the people around us. We can also call upon those energies to self-regulate when we're faced with unbalanced states in others. You know, when you're faced with somebody's intense anger, that's pretty, you know, that can destabilize us, right? Because it's scary. So we can call on those stabilizing energies in ourselves when someone else's state is frightening or overwhelming. Our very neurons resonate with the intense states of others. So, you know, we are programmed to feel others' states, even if we sometimes think we're not paying attention, or sometimes we distance ourselves, but we're affected more than we may even realize. That's part of our makeup, and we need to be that way as human beings. We need to be able to be aware of others' states and assess them, and so that we can respond wisely. But we are programmed, actually weighted more in the direction of detecting threats, right? So we tend to overcompensate in that direction. And so that's why these abilities to regulate ourselves are really important. And sometimes, you know, if we've had particular kinds of trauma in our earlier life, we kick into defense mode quite quickly. So self-awareness is a pretty important capacity for living in the world with other people. It's much easier to live with the trees and the birds than with each other sometimes. But we can ground ourselves. We can ground ourselves with our bodies, our feet on the ground. We breathe in and out with awareness, not knowing what's coming next. We can be informed by, but not bound by, past experience. We can be ready to respond to right now, what comes next. As humans, our relationship to Earth is intimate. Think of the words humus and human, which relate to being humble of this Earth, and humid, moist. That's what humus is. It's the dark, moist layer of soil that's composed of decayed organic matter, right? That's what makes topsoil good topsoil, is humus. Humus is rather poorly understood. Gardeners know that stable humus helps a porous sandy soil hold more water, but it also helps a heavy clay soil hold less water. A pound of sand holds 1/4 pound of water. A pound of humus holds 2 pounds of water, 4 times as much. There's a wonderful book called Dirt, The Ecstatic Skin of the Earth. Isn't that a great line? By William Bryant Logan. And he says that humus is unique among biological substances in that it resists the process of microbial decay and can remain in the soil sometimes for 10,000 years, thousands of years or more. And yet, soil chemists have been trying to pin down exactly what humus is for decades without success. Apparently, every time you try and break it down into its basic components, you get acids of slightly different identity. Logan in the book says, radical disorder is the key to the functions of humus. At the molecular level, it may be indeed the most disordered material on Earth. No two molecules of humus may be alike. Isn't this cool? Though no one has difficulty in recognizing a humus molecule, it is quite likely unique because it works upon fractal principles. Simple geometries define any given part of it, but the modes for the combining of these shapes produce a vast array of different manifestations at different scales. For humus, similarity is rampant, but identity non-existent. Like snowflakes. Like us. Similarity is rampant. Identity is non-existent. So I thought what I'd like, before we're going to go outdoors pretty soon, but I thought first I'd like us to do just kind of a little contemplation of the elements. So please stretch a little bit and then get yourself in a comfortable position. And you can close your eyes for this if you'd like. Or, you know, just softly half open, whatever you like. And we're going to contemplate the four elements. We'll just do four. Earth, water, fire, and air. Within and without the body. And this is a very, very old practice. I'm doing it rather freely, adapting it, but this practice of observing the four elements in the body and around us. It can be found in the earliest Buddhist texts in the Pali Canon. So I like to think that the Buddha taught this because he spent a lot of time outside too, in the forests with his monks and nuns. So the first element we'll contemplate is the earth element, which represents the solid nature of matter. So feel the solidity of your body as it sits. Feel the supporting structure of the skeleton. You might actually want to kind of feel one hand with the other hand. Kind of feel the solidity there. The muscles and the tendons and the cartilage, connecting the moving parts of the body. How the solid parts support this flexible, permeable bag of skin which contains us. This bag of skin with its openings to allow the inflow of nourishment and the outflow of waste. So solid material moves into and out from us. And the marvelous complexity of the passages in this body that move blood, lymph, nerve signals, air, and food throughout our body. Feel the pull of gravity holding the bulk of our body to our seats. On another planet, we might just float right off our seats. This is how we feel on this planet, right here. Think of the mineral elements that make up this solid body. What are we reduced to when the life force no longer animates this bag of water and earth? A pile of bones? A puff of ash? Now contemplate the earth element outside the body. Feel the firmness of the cushion or the chair beneath you. Be aware of the structure of this building, its foundation. And beyond the building, this mountainside. The many living things that inhabit it. Feel the presence of this great planet hosting the skin thin of life on her surface. And yet beyond this planet, we are connected to many bodies moving through unimaginable space in the universe, the solar system, galaxy, and beyond. We are made of the same cosmic dust as they. Think of the elements in your body, how many living bodies they have passed through. And how far will the elements that form us disperse when we are no longer our bodies? Now let's contemplate the water element within us. Water, this miraculous substance that is both fluid and cohesive. It flows and it also holds solid particles within it. It has tremendous carrying power. The salt water that fills our cells, the same salt water that fills the oceans, gives us our shape and most of our weight. Blood and lymph constantly circulating, renewing us. Mucus. Lubricating the passages of our bodies. Tears that flow to cleanse our eyes and reduce the toxins of stress. This marvelous system by which we drink in fluids, extract their mineral wealth, and excrete the rest. The water in us makes us buoyant in the sea. It responds like the tides to the pull of the moon. The water in us rises as steam with the smoke from our funeral pyre. Next, we'll contemplate the water element outside the body. That elegant water cycle that nourishes all life on earth. The falling of the rain and snow, gently or fiercely. The ever downward running of streams, creeks, rivers, gathering into ponds, lakes, and the great earth-encircling oceans, cradles of life. The rising up again of water vapor into endless variety of clouds, ice crystals, snowflakes that melt on your tongue. Water running always through us and around us. Every molecule of water in your body has passed through countless other bodies. We are quite literally reincarnated. Next, we contemplate the fire element in the body. This is the element of heat, transformation, metabolism. Just scan a little bit through your body, starting at the top and descending, and noticing the quality of warmth or coolness in the different parts of your body, the different energy centers of your body. The throat and the heart are areas that often most reflect your emotional state. Whether our muscles are contracted or relaxed, whether our breath is shallow or deep, these factors will affect the blood circulation and the heat regulation in our body. Notice the warmth in your belly. Maybe you're still digesting your breakfast. How amazing! The way our digestive system metabolizes the food we eat and turns it into energy to fuel our cells. All the different jobs our cells do to keep our bodies running. Notice your extremities, your hands and feet, whether they're cool or warm. Near death, our extremities cool as the fire within us slowly dies. Now contemplate the fire element outside the body. Feel the warmth of the air in the room. Coolness if you're near a window. The warmth coming to us from the great powerhouse of the sun, both directly and indirectly, through the lives of the beings whose bodies nourish us through our food, consider photosynthesis, the way plants make food out of sunlight, carbon dioxide, and water. One of the two most fundamental of biological processes. The other being the process of burning, by which plants and animals transform that captured sunlight into heat energy to fuel growth and life. We could say that all life is burning, consuming and being consumed. Consider the sun's energy stored in those ancient beings whose bodies were transformed into the oil and gas that, for the time being, fuels our human civilization. Now let's contemplate the air element within the body. Air is the element of movement, wind, passing in and out of our bodies on the miracle of our breath, renewing our cells with oxygen from the moment we take our first breath to the moment we breathe our last. Inspiration, expiration. Full, empty. And then let's contemplate the air element outside the body, enveloping us, permeating us. What is inside? What is outside? Air is the most ephemeral of elements. We can't even see it. Unless it moves the branches of the tree or ruffles the surface of the lake. Or fills with smoke or water vapor. Air carries sound waves to us. What comes to us as sound? What leaves us as sound? Spend just a moment more opening with all our senses to the humming of the elements as they come together in our bodies and all around us in constant flux. Thank you for doing that with me. And I'm just going to close with a paraphrase from Logan, who wrote the book about dirt. He's kind of a mystic of dirt. Soil is the darkest and coldest of all living things, the most widespread and the most receptive. Warmed, it blooms. So may we, in our darkest moments, be attentive to the penetrating rays of the sun that finds in us the seed of awakening. So thank you all for your kind listening. May our intention be extended to every